Accession number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 13.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 13. On what day did you leave for Cos?
We finally found ourselves in a bivouac camp. We're actually in two-man pup tents in a scorpion-infested area not far from Haifa. And we were still not informed as to where we were about to proceed. However, during the early hours of the 16th of September, 1943, my company, C Company, were warned to be in readiness to embark on transport, which would soon arrive. This, in fact, took place. We found ourselves being transported in these troop carriers to Ramat David Airfield on the outskirts of Haifa town. And later during the day, we were put aboard air transport, which I remember were RAF Dakotas, or certainly Dakotas, possibly flown by Dominion pilots. We were soon airborne above the Mediterranean Sea, and I must say that this was a novel experience for most of us. I certainly had never flown before, and most of my companions were in a similar situation. After some hours uneventful flying, we appeared over the island of Kos, which is one of the Dodecanese group off the coast of Turkey. During the flight, we had been told that this indeed was to be our destination, and Colonel Kirby, who was the commanding officer, who was accompanying our company on this advance party, told us that we didn't know what to expect. The Italians had been in occupation, but it was believed, but not at that time confirmed, that the company of parachutists had cleared the island of any potential opposition. But nevertheless, we were instructed to do our job as we landed and disgorged from the aircraft and take up defensive positions around the airfield in order first to protect the aircraft, in order to give them a safe return takeoff, and remain in a protected position in order to allow the remainder of the battalion to arrive safely. We remained in this position until the 18th of September, when the rest of the battalion were flown in onto this rather rough airstrip. We were all by this time digging in around the airfield in a protective situation, and our company at that juncture were ordered into occupying position in the town itself, which was at the other end of the island.
What supporting weapons did you have, if any?
At that time, we had none. The heavy weapons, the anti-tank guns or whatever we had in that description hadn't arrived. The heaviest supporting weapon we had were 3-inch mortar platoon weapons at that time. The carrier platoon were not brought in up for obvious reasons. Transport aircraft at that time were not capable of carrying these heavy machinery. For some reason, best known to the higher authority, the seaborne carrying vessels were not made available in order to provide this additional support arm, which unfortunately had to be left behind. So we were basically a semi-naked battalion as far as supporting arms are concerned, having only our 3-inch mortars to back us up.
Were you aware of this, that if you had any problems, that this is basically what you were equipped with?
At that time, we had not been informed as to the eventual intention of the occupation. Most of it, in fact, regarded it as a holiday. Certainly the climate was that of a holiday. The local population were very pleased to see us, and obviously had no time for the Italians. They'd been treated rather roughly, I believe. But no, we expected and trusted that those in command had ensured our future safety as far as supporting arms are concerned, and obviously, as one learned later, this was not to be the case.
Did the rest of the battalion arrive without any interference?
A and B Company and D Company arrived without any bother at all, and took up positions around the airfield, a protective ring. A Company, however, were not quite so lucky. Their little flight on the way across lost one aircraft, which was forced down, and eventually they were rescued by some Turkish seaborne craft, I believe, and interned for a short period of time on the Turkish mainland by their authorities. But certainly by the 23rd of September or thereabouts, the battalion was in occupation of the island of Kos, which was at the nearest point, some 15 miles seaward from the Turkish coast. C Company, in defence and occupation of the town itself and the small harbour, where we were busily engaged disgorging goods which were arriving by sea at that time. A and B Companies moved nearer to the town astride the road leading in from the airfield, while D Company, under the command of Major John Thorpe, stayed on the airfield as a local defence.
The defensive positions you were taking up in the town, how did you do that? Because obviously you must have been houses, and there was observation. And
yes, it's a pretty little town. We, in fact, got a choice place. We, once again, a school. It seemed to be a favoured billet, a non-occupied school. We had this rather modern-looking school with an internal quadrangle, and we had quite a cushy billet there. It was easily kept clean. It was clean when we went in. The other platoons were in surrounding buildings, and we were lucky. We had the best billet of the battalion. In fact, we had modern sanitation. We had good cooking arrangements. At that time, we had plenty of food and rations, and the daily arrival of various ships were delivering more supplies. So the situation, at least for a couple of weeks, was one of a holiday. We were working hard when called upon, so to do, discharging goods from the incoming ship and doing necessary routine jobs around the company area. But most afternoons and evenings were spent frolicking off the Greek kites which were in the harbour and swimming around.
You weren't operating and opening up fields of fire?
Oh yes, part of the daily routine, in fact, was preparing a defensive position towards the outskirts of the town, astride the road and along certain slopes, which afforded good fields of fire for any of the troops who were likely to eventually possibly advance along that line. So apart from having a good time during our off-duty hours, we had by certainly 2 weeks prepared adequate defensive positions which could be occupied at a minute's notice. And in fact, regularly we were practised in this art.
Were they good defensive positions, bearing in mind what was to come?
Yes, I think so. Of course, the fields of fire weren't extensive, talking in terms of distance, because olive groves and fruit groves, fruit green trees, grew close up to the fringe of the town. But we under the guidance of our company commander and various other NCOs of seniority, we situated our guns and chose fields of fire which would be adequate to the situation.
What happened next?
Well, the things were rather quiet. There were one or two disturbing incidents or rumours arose from. The odd explosion here and there. One rumour had it that there were still Italian saboteurs roaming the island. And so a sharp watch was kept on armories and storage dumps, petrol dumps and ammunition dumps, etc. I never personally saw any of this going on, but I've reason to believe now that it was in fact true. There were some elements amongst the population who didn't like us there whatsoever. Things, as I say, were reasonably quiet, and then gradually the incoming vessels ceased to arrive, and we began to ask questions: well, what's happening, and how are we going to be supplied? And in fact, the delivery via sea dried up completely. And by this time, the enemy air force had become active. Gradually, and until it became a daily visit, three or four times a day, high-level bombing, certainly on Cos Harbour and around the town, but mainly concentrated their efforts on the airfield, which they seemed determined to destroy. It had been used since our arrival by a squadron of South African Spitfires, who unfortunately weren't sufficiently well-versed in aerial combat. And within a short space of time, the whole squadron had been shot down or burnt on the ground.
Was this worrying you as you were seeing this kind of thing happening? Your supplies going up, Air Force coming in.
Yes, we could be considered to be by this time really seasoned soldiers, and we knew what should be happening. We were in occupation of an island, which had been coveted by the enemy forces, and in fact certain people have said we're not going to have a discussion of this much longer. As I've said, the seaborne supply route had been stopped for some reason or other, and of course the reason being that air superiority prevented the seaborne craft arriving. The journey from our nearest friendly spot was Cyprus. We had occasional visits from a gallant squadron of bow fighters who occasionally visited the island, but they were far too outmaneuvered by the enemy fighters, and so they gradually withdrew. And in any case, the range was so extended they could only stay for a very short time above the island. We eventually, our main and only source of supply for both fuel and food, mainly food, was from the air, and possibly the same squadron of Dakotas which had previously flown us in from Palestine were detailed to drop supplies by night, and this was carried out on several occasions. The system involved has been seen on television many times. All petrol tins were half filled with sand, soaked with petrol, placed in a dropping marked zone. And on a given signal by the officer in charge, they were lit, providing a flare path which created a DZ for the aircraft who dropped the parachutes containing our rations. Gradually, even this sort of supply ceased to function on account of enemy air superiority. Their light fighters became operational, and so we were then... We were left to fend for ourselves. We had nothing coming in by sea. We had nothing coming in by air. The Royal Navy said they were unable to come to our assistance because the enemy had air superiority. Our Air Force were unable to combat this threat. And it was a strange situation to be in. We once again, I suppose, were in a beleaguered situation. We were getting used to this. We were once more a siege battalion. However, we managed to survive. The rations which had been dropped were carefully cosseted, and once again we were placed on short rations. Eventually, the expected assault arrived. We all knew, really, in our own hearts, that we were due for a hammering. We'd heard that the island to the north had been attacked by the Germans, the island of Samos and Leros, who had been occupied by the two other brigade battalions. We knew nothing about the result, however. Our island had been selected for extra attention because we had the only airfield in the Dodecanese. the whole thing came to a head on the morning of the 4th of October, still in the early hours of the morning, in total darkness. We received the silent alarm and quickly went off and occupied our defensive positions. Word came through from the Ford companies that German parachutists had dropped near the airfield in an attempt to occupy it and seal it off. D Company were immediately engaged in action against the enemy forces who had been landed on their heads. Colonel Kirby, all during this initial landing, was in hospital with some strange tropical disease. Apparently, immediately on hearing the latest news of the situation, loaned a motorcycle without permission from a nearby building and rejoined the battalion. During this time, during his absence, of course, Major Fawkes had assumed temporary command of the battalion.
When did you start becoming involved in this?
At first light, we knew, or we were told, that John Thorpe and his company, who had previously been responsible for airfield defence, had been either killed or mostly wounded or severely damaged, and had to withdraw along the road towards the town of Cos, which meant that the Germans had occupied the airfield. Not that it mattered to us much, because we didn't have any aircraft to put on it in any case. So this was one clangor, I think, that the Germans had wasted a lot of men on. But as the first light developed, daylight arose, we were intensely occupied with making sure that our guns were operational and finding the odd bird in the air to make sure we were ready. An order was then issued for the company to stride the road to withdraw near to the town, which they did. One company commander, I think it was Major Jim Gray, took part of his company to a vacated Italian field gun position and offered any assistance. But it wasn't required, as I think there were no ammunition left anyway for the gun to operate with. Towards the middle of the day, the sound of battle filled the air. The local population went to ground. The enemy aircraft were over the island continuously, aircraft of all sorts, shapes and sizes. Our old friend the Stukas revelled in the fact that we'd no aircraft to fly against them. The few Bofa guns which had been landed by sea were not operational. And the situation was becoming critical, to say the least. All this time, of course, we were on tenterhooks. The colour sergeant was gallantly supplying us with food, as were the other companies, CQ messes. The regiment sergeant major was doing a gallant job ferrying ammunition to the Ford companies, and so it enabled them to stave off any final assault by the Germans who had landed by this time. Later we were told that the ratio as far as man-to-man was concerned was something like 10 Germans to one British soldier. And so once again the Germans were up against it. However, the fight continued and resistance continued until about tea time, 4 p.m. when an order group was called by the commander to discuss possible future action of the battalion. Unfortunately, whilst this old group was forming, the German mortars accidentally or otherwise ranged in successfully on them and caused fatal injuries to our regiment sergeant major, or quartermaster, I should say, John Bush. Immediately, field commission was awarded to regimental sergeant major George Flanagan, who became quartermaster on the spot. This was a damaging blow. John Bush was a great fellow, a much admired officer, and a terrible loss to the battalion.
Were there other officers wounded?
Yes, I think there were. Now, certainly in that mortar explosion, John Bush was killed or died shortly after being wounded. I'm trying to remember the other. I'm sure another officer was injured. It would be a company commander or the adjutant. I just can't place his name.
Had you become involved in any firefight at this stage?
No, we'd not been called upon, and one was realising in this situation that it's not a free for all. One didn't fire off at anything at all. Strict fire control was the order of the day, as part of our training had been, I was told it. And therefore, even up to this point, we hadn't even sighted the enemy, so no target had presented itself. Had it done so, it would have been met with fierce opposition. Shortly after this debacle with the O group, the order was sent through. Rumours circulated that once again the drones would be involved in a bayonet assault. But I believe that due to the fact that it was soon realised, even by Jim Gray, the officer who had suggested this gallant gesture or action, that occupying oneself in a bayonet assault through thick olive groves and orange trees was out of the question. We would be a serious disadvantage in exposing ourselves unnecessarily. And therefore, this suggestion was squashed. And later on, towards dusk, we were informed that escape and evasion tactics were to be adopted, something we'd not done a lot of training in, but we knew something about it. The idea being that suitably lightly equipped with whatever food we could carry and water bottles, etc., we would, in an orderly fashion, disperse and head for the hills, making ourselves as scarce as possible. And if the opportunity presented itself, cause as much confusion and sabotage to the enemy's efforts.
Was this in effect to go into a guerrilla type of situation?
Yes, this was the intention. But then again, we'd at least the leading companies, which had this time been almost decimated, must have expended most of their ammunition. So, as far as they were concerned, they would have little to fight with at that stage of the game. And apart from the serious casualty situation, the little ammunition left with which to fight. We hadn't fired a shot up to this stage of the game, and all our ammunition and weapons were intact. So, carrying what we could, Russians, the newly appointed quartermaster by a shrouded hurricane lamp, we fired past his table, and he handed out the remainder of the emergency rations which had been dropped by the quarters on previous occasions.
How did you personally feel at this stage that you were in effect in a trap situation again, and yes, even more desperate this time because you were having to break away?
Well, I think we all thought that the same. So here we go again. We've got the thick end of the stick again. Nothing behind us, everything on top of us, and a lot in front of us. But I think it made us even more determined to get the hell out of it. The order had been given, and we had to carry out the order. So off we trotted, or marched. We set off at darker eye. We set off silently. Silent march and orderly withdrawal was the order of the night. And we set off towards the highest point of the island, above the town of Cos, intending to pass through onto the northern side of the island, which was known to be steep and rocky.
Was this done as a company battalion, or did you break into smaller groups?
No, as we passed up the mountain, this party, which moved from Cos up the side of the mountain, consisted mainly of C Company. After all, we would just left our defensive position. The other companies may have been a mile or so further up the road towards Antimachia, where the airfield was situated, and their immediate action would have been to turn left up the hills nearest to them. So they would be possibly 2 or 3 miles away from us, heading up the towards the middle of the island, towards the high points. We carried on having frequent halts. It was extremely steep, and we were on at times walking across scree, which didn't give one a good foothold, 3 feet forward and 2 feet back of the situation. We were carrying boxes of ammunition and grenades, And I remember one officer, Beagle Birchenoff by name, a tall, gangly young officer, bringing up the rear, soon to be laden down with ready prime 36 grenades, saying that, in his own words, if any of the bastards get behind us, we'll get this lot on them. And he acted as a rear guard as we made our way up the side of the mountain. By first light, we had reached almost the top when the sound of aircraft became apparent and a call to halt and immediate personal camouflage was given. And this was, I think, the first and only time that the much-abused gas cape came into its own. Each individual rapidly produced his gas cape from the neat roll on the back of his haversack, covered himself with it, and crouched behind any nearest rock or boulder. Shortly after this, our friends the Stukas arrived for an early morning run and selected, situated just below us, possibly 200 or 300 feet, or 200 or 300 feet below us toward the coast, a deserted Italian gun emplacement in the form of a large pillbox, which they severely pounded. We had a grandstand view. We were actually sitting looking down on this operation, and the pilots were flying past at eye level. And how the hell they never noticed any of us got on in it. We expected to be Stuka the machine at any time. This operation by the Stukas took about 20 minutes or so. They made two or three sorties against this same target and then decided to look around elsewhere for targets. And I believe they went near to the town, of course, where they obviously located our petrol dump and proceeded to attack it. I don't think they had any success. At least we saw no smoke as a result. And eventually they flew off. Having waited a reasonable, a safe time, we pushed on, and by about 9 o'clock, 9:30 in the morning, we reached the crest of the highest point on the end of the island above the town, and went through this narrow pass onto the north side of the island, facing the Turkish mainland, which was plainly visible across the Dodecanese or the Aegean Sea.
At this stage, were you still a pretty large group?
We were some 25 or 26 men in our party by this time, which meant that we'd lost about 10 men. We'd left 10 men along the route who were either unable to keep up or decided to make their own way, which was in accordance with the instructions in any case. Beagle Birchenoff, the officer I'd referred to recently, I last saw standing at the entrance to this narrow pass through which we were passing, encouraging to get a move on with a grenade in each hand, acting as a most efficient rear guard. That's the last I saw of him. I believe later that he managed to evade capture and got away safely.
Did you have any maps of the area?
None whatsoever. We'd seen plans, rough plans of the island since our arrival. In fact, there were one or two in the school in which we were using as a billet. And from this, we knew that the side of the island upon which we were now situated, facing the Turkish mainland, was it sloped steeply towards the sea. It was rugged, interspersed with steep, dry wadis, waterfalls, watercourses, I should say. And there was only one small town of any size on that side of the island, a place called Cardamina. We intended, therefore, to make our way towards Cardamina with a view to obtaining a suitable means of transport across the sea to Turkey as a means of escape. But in a short space of time, we realised that we wouldn't make it. The Germans would have been across in order to cut us off from that point.
Had you at any time understood or been told that there would be some assistance to get you off the island?
No.
So at this stage, the question of special boat services never arose.
Never.
You were looking for your own way off.
Well, special services up to that time were a thing which we hardly recognised. They were the new thing, as far as I'm concerned. We certainly weren't aware of the fact that the presence was there. They were near anywhere in or near the island, and so it was essentially an escape, an evasion operation, and it was every man for himself as a last resort.